This is the BBC.
Order, order.
Hello, this is Sean Curran at Westminster with the Today in Parliament podcast for Tuesday the 14th of November, when MPs started looking at the details in the legislation that will take the UK out of the European Union. And they began with an argument about the date of departure. A Brexit minister told them the UK was leaving at 11 p.m. on the 29th of March 2019.
We recognise the importance of being crystal clear on the setting of exit day.
But opposition MPs say the proposal is a gimmick and window dressing.
This exit day is simply a sop to the backbenchers. When's he going to tell them the truth?
Also on the programme, calls for a clampdown on tax havens in the wake of the so-called Paradise Papers. Ministers say they've taken action.
Aggressive tax avoidance and evasion are utterly wrong.
And former military commanders warn MPs the armed forces are at breaking point.
I imagine the First Sea Lord has a choice between having his left arm cut off or his right arm cut off.
Next week, the Chancellor will deliver his budget. One of the biggest dates in the political calendar will provide a parliamentary interlude in between arguments and rows over the details of how the UK will leave the European Union. MPs will spend 8 days, spread over several weeks, debating the legislation that will pave the way for Brexit by repealing the Act taking the UK into what was then called the European Community. It'll also transfer all existing EU legislation into British law. The focus during the first debate was on when the UK will leave the EU. The Prime Minister wants to change the European Union withdrawal bill so that Brexit takes place at 11 p.m. on the 29th of March 2019. MPs will vote on that amendment later in the year. But a Labour former minister, Frank Field, had suggested a similar change. He wanted the bill to spell out that the UK would cease to belong to the EU on the 30th of March 2019.
My amendment decides on British time when to leave. Their amendment is at the beckoning of Europeans. So we have actually a very clear choice.
Mr. Field, who described himself as a reluctant Brexiteer, said his amendment would help set the UK on the course of leaving the EU.
Maybe it's a fallacy to think in one's own terms and have terms for the nation. But do you know, I've never bought a house without having in the contract the date when it's mine, when I can actually get in.
He was challenged by the Labour MP sitting next to him, Hilary Benn, the chair of the Commons Brexit Committee, who said no one set a date for buying a house until they knew what they were buying.
The Secretary of State said to us when he came to appear before the Select Committee that it is possible that the negotiations may go to the 59th minute of the 11th hour, and that is undoubtedly possible. In those circumstances, does it really make sense to bind the hands of the country and those who are negotiating on behalf of the country to get the best possible deal we can get, which is also the weakness of the government's own amendment? Does it make sense to do that?
As the my honourable friend, right honourable friend, was kind to me about the house analogy, I've always bought my houses, never inherited them.
I bought mine too.
Very good.
Hilary Benn shouted out, "I didn't, I bought mine too," and Frank Field later apologised for his comments. At the moment, the EU withdrawal bill is 60 pages long. MPs have tabled hundreds of amendments. Frank Field thought the legislation should have been a lot shorter, and he warned the government that the bill didn't stand much chance of getting through the House of Lords. His comments prompted an intervention from a Conservative Eurosceptic, Sir Bill Cash.
The House of Lords is, of course, unelected. It has actually also passed the Referendum Act itself by its own decision, and it really has no justification whatsoever for attempting to obstruct, delay, or to undermine this bill.
A very, very, very important lesson needs to go to some of those in the House of Lords who think they can wreck this bill and wear us down so that Brexit never takes place.
Frank Field said he'd be willing to press what he called the nuclear button and abolish the House of Lords if peers tried to block or derail Brexit. The Brexit minister, Steve Baker, wanted Mr. Field to drop his proposal and support the government's amendment setting a time and date for the UK's departure. Mr. Baker was challenged by a Liberal Democrat, Vera Hobhouse.
Will the minister not agree that exactly this argument is creating division between us and our European neighbours, which will make it very difficult to create a deep and special partnership?
Well, I don't accept that at all, no, because when the Prime Minister wrote to the President of the European Council in March last year, she set in train the defined two-year process of Article 50, which, unless it is extended by unanimity, will come to a conclusion on the 29th of March 2019.
Mr. Baker said the government wanted to put the issue to rest.
We recognise the importance of being crystal clear on the setting of exit day, and the government is keen to provide the certainty that the Right Honourable Member for Birkenhead and others are seeking.
Labour's shadow Brexit Minister Paul Blomfield dismissed the government's amendment as a gimmick, and the SNP's Joanna Cherry said it was political window dressing in light of the Prime Minister's desire for a transitional deal.
And that means we'll be staying in the single market, staying in the customs union and subject to EU law during the transition period. So this exit day is simply a sop to the backbenchers. When's he going to tell them the truth?
Perhaps more significantly, the proposals were also criticised by Conservative rebels. This was the Conservative former Attorney General, Dominic Grieve.
I find this amendment by the government so very strange, because it seems to me to fetter the government, to add nothing to the strength of the government's negotiating position, and in fact potentially to create a very great problem that could be brought back to visit or to be visited on us at a later stage.
And the former Chancellor Kenneth Clark said the proposal to set a departure date was ridiculous and unnecessary.
There are some very, very serious issues to be settled in this bill, and I ask the government to reconsider silly amendments thrown out because they got a good article in the Daily Telegraph, which actually might do harm.
That applause came from the opposition benches. After 4 hours of debate, Frank Field withdrew his proposal. MPs went on to reject an amendment from Plaid Cymru's Howell Williams to make the repeal of the 1972 European Communities Act conditional on the government getting the consent of the devolved legislatures. And the Commons voted to keep Clause 1 of the bill by 318 votes to 68, a government majority of 250. The clause simply says the European Communities Act 1972 will be repealed on exit day. Well, we'll return to that Brexit debate later in the programme. But for now, the government has been told it should compel British overseas territories and crown dependencies, such as Bermuda and the Isle of Man, to do away with secretive tax arrangements. The Labour MP, Dame Margaret Hodge, said the UK had powers to tackle tax avoidance in British jurisdictions, just as it had outlawed the death penalty and discrimination against gay people. Christina Cooper reports.
Financial documents leaked last week, dubbed the Paradise Papers, showed how wealthy individuals and companies were putting their money into jurisdictions with low tax regimes. They revealed that so-called offshore schemes had been used by the Queen, the rock star Bono, and the Formula One driver Lewis Hamilton. Dame Margaret Hodge, who's been campaigning on tax avoidance for several years, was appalled by the latest revelations.
The actions and the culture of powerful large corporations and of the wealthiest in our society, as revealed in the Paradise Papers, constitute a national and international disgrace.
The Chancellor, Philip Hammond, is putting the finishing touches to his budget to be unveiled next week. Margaret Hodge hoped he would take on board some of her suggestions on tax avoidance. Another Labour MP, Jack Dromey, wondered if the magic money tree existed after all.
There is no such thing as a magic money tree, the Prime Minister told a nurse who had not had an increase in 8 years. Does the Right Honourable Lady agree with me that there is, that they grow on the Cayman Islands, in Bermuda and in Jersey, and that were the ill-gotten gains salted away of tax dodging to be picked and put into our public services, we would not have police officers and teachers facing the sack and a crisis in the health service.
Margaret Hodge replied that paying tax was an essential part of the social contract, in which citizens abide by rules that make everyone's lives better.
One of those rules is that we agree to contribute through taxation into the common pot for the common good.
A Conservative, Rebecca Powell, agreed with much of what she was saying, but insisted the government was on the right track.
It's this government who has invested £1.8 million in HMRC to tackle tax avoidance, and indeed we have lessened the gap by 2% more than Labour did.
Margaret Hodge had a figure of her own, namely that the tax gap could be £120 billion.
I think she will share with me a determination to see much more action to deal with something which is just an ill in our society. Yeah.
Many of the Paradise Papers originate from the law firm Appleby, which is based in Bermuda, a British overseas territory. Margaret Hodge advocated compelling those areas, as well as Crown dependencies such as Jersey, to publish public registers of company ownership.
In the past, a Conservative government has used its powers to outlaw capital punishment in our Crown dependencies and overseas territories, and a Labour government used the same powers to outlaw discrimination against gay people. Today, we should work together to outlaw the secrecy of these jurisdictions that leads to such massive tax injustices.
The Treasury Minister, Mel Stride, thought there was a shared view.
That aggressive tax avoidance and evasion are utterly wrong.
He set about listing what the government had been doing to tackle aggressive tax avoidance.
We have raised, Mr Speaker, £160 billion in additional revenues as a consequence of clamping down on tax avoidance, evasion and non-compliance since 2010.
A Conservative, Andrew Mitchell, insisted tax avoidance was not a party political issue and there was only one plausible criticism to be made of the government.
They need to speed up some of the initiatives they have already implemented. But the government hasn't done that in respect of the overseas territories because obviously we'd rather these havens took action themselves. And to be fair, to some extent, they have already started to do so.
Several MPs, including the SNP's Neil Gray, thought Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs didn't have enough staff to cope with tax avoiders.
When tax officers gain a significant tax return on to the Treasury against their salaries, wouldn't it be better if we were to invest in and not cut tax officers, and go after that multi-billion pound tax gap? Yeah.
The Minister challenged the assumption that nothing was being done, saying that 75 changes had been introduced since 2010. He concluded that the government had been so active that many new measures had gone unnoticed.
Christina Cooper. The rollout of universal credit to families with children should be paused, the Children's Commissioner for England has told MPs. Universal credit merges six benefits for working-age people into one new payment. The rollout of the new system across the UK accelerated last month, with about 50 job centres now being added every month. Anne Longfield told the Education Committee there was already evidence that families with children were suffering.
Families with more than two children very hard hit, and actually lone parents as well, hard hit within that too. So I do think we've got a set of families whose life is quite precarious. Often they're the ones in work, and I'm not sure that actually everyone's recognised that, that the new poor and the new insecure are those in insecure work.
The government has said the change will make it easier for people to get benefits. But Anne Longfield said the impact of universal credit hadn't been tested on families with children.
It does mean now we're moving into rollout, not knowing what that means. So one of the things that I'll be asking the Chancellor to do is to pause universal credit rollout for families with children until we better understand what that means.
The Children's Commissioner for England. Coming up, as the budget approaches, MPs step up their calls for more health spending. But first, former senior military officers have told MPs that years of cuts have left the UK's armed forces close to breaking. The warning came as the Defence Committee looked at attempts to make £20 billion of efficiency savings. There were concerns too in the Lords, where peers said reduced defence spending could leave the UK unable to maintain its international commitments. Nick Qureshi reports.
The Army, Royal Navy and the RAF have been asked to put forward options for spending reductions as the Ministry of Defence struggles to control spending. The Royal Navy's list of saving options include cuts to the Royal Marines, as well as axing the Navy's two amphibious assault ships, HMS Albion and HMS Bulwark. The Conservative MP, Johnny Mercer, himself a former army officer, began the questioning.
Would you accept it's quite hard for the British public to accept that we put a lot of public money into doing a strategic defence review just 2 years ago, and we are so sort of poor at looking at forward threats that 2 years later we have to do the whole thing again, and that they might find that quite difficult to swallow?
Sir Mark Lyle Grant, a national security adviser, helped put together the strategic defence review in 2015.
Since 2015, there are certain developments that have happened which do draw into question some of the affordability of the 2015 review, like the depreciation of the pound against the dollar and the euro, like the fact that the Ministry of Defence has not actually so far been able to deliver all the efficiencies that were agreed as part of this process in the first place, and partly also because some of the programmes, the equipment programmes, the costs have gone up.
Admiral Sir George Zambellis, a former chief of the naval staff, said the armed forces were facing a stark choice.
Certainly the three of us know that defence has been under-resourced for years. Then the challenge that's been set to the chief of staffs now is to try to make further savings. And so, as is the style of these things, each service chief has been invited to find or consider areas where they might make reductions. So I imagine the First Sea Lord has a choice between having his left arm cut off or his right arm cut off.
Those thoughts were echoed by General Sir Richard Barons, head of Joint Forces Command for 3 years.
Defence is close to breaking, and unless you put more money in it, it will fall over. And that does not fit the risk the country is now running. And no matter how people dress it up, that is the issue you're confronted.
He added,
if we want an army that can actually fight, it's got to acquire some modern capabilities, cyber, social media, and all. It's also got to re-energise itself for contemporary hard power conflict. It's miles from being able to do that.
Concern about defence cuts was also raised in the House of Lords. Air Marshal Lord Craig, a former Chief of Defence Staff, highlighted comments from the US Commander of Forces in Europe. General Ben Hodges warned the UK wouldn't be able to maintain its international commitments if the armed forces faced further cuts. Lord Craig wanted to know,
can he therefore confirm that there is no intention which would earn further rebuke to cut the size of our armed forces, for example, in the Royal Marines, or to curtail flying training as for helicopter pilots?
For the government, Lord Courtauld said defence budgets were under pressure.
Any speculation about the measures the government will take through the NSCR is exactly that, speculation, my lords. No decisions have been taken. Rumours in the press have been misleading and deeply unhelpful.
That didn't satisfy Labour's Lord Tunnicliffe.
We're to have a national security and capability review. That's code for more defence cuts.
The former Liberal Democrat leader, Lord Campbell, had concerns too.
Is it not the case, the harsh, unpalatable truth, that we're cutting in not to fat or even muscle, but now into the very bones of our defence capability? How else can one explain the decision, not speculative, but in fact, to reduce the number of replacement Apache helicopters from 50 to 38, and further, to be considering the sale of HMS Albion?
Lord Courtauld repeated there were always pressures on defence budgets, but he said the government would continue to enable the armed forces to carry out the job asked of them in defending the UK.
Nick Qureshi. This week, the BBC learned that several hundred Islamic State fighters and their families were allowed to leave the Syrian city of Raqqa when it fell to US-backed forces. Labour's Lord Collins was concerned that the agreement had enabled militants to spread across the region.
These fighters have gone somewhere. They've not disappeared. And there is a potential threat to neighbouring countries. What assessment has the government done in terms of the threat to neighbouring countries, and particularly countries that are fighting Daesh? And also, what assessment has the noble Lord, the Minister, made on this release of fighters, on our ability to hold these criminals to account?
For the government, Lord Ahmed said Britain had not been involved in the local agreement and didn't condone it, but he said it had been aimed at minimising civilian casualties.
We are continuing to work with the coalition on the ground, that's 73 different countries, including several neighbouring countries, to ensure that those who are seeking to leave the conflict zone, both in Syria and indeed in Iraq, that they're held accountable either locally or indeed if they do return, and those foreign fighters who seek to return to the UK, that there is due process, as you will know, in place to ensure that they are held to account for their crimes abroad.
Lord Ahmed. Later, the House of Lords approved the bill, which allows the government to set a budget for Northern Ireland. The decision to introduce a budget came after the failure of talks to restore the power-sharing executive at Stormont. Speaking for the government, Lord Duncan said ministers had to act to make sure public services didn't run out of money. But he said it wasn't a move to direct rule. The budget bill is expected to get royal assent on Thursday. Now, last week saw the unusual spectacle of a senior public official openly demanding more money ahead of the budget. Simon Stevens, the head of NHS England, said without a significant hike in funding, waiting lists for routine surgery in England would rise to 5 million. Labour seized on those comments, as Mandy Baker reports.
Simon Stevens proved to be a recurring theme at Health Questions. Last week, he made headlines by saying that now we were leaving the EU, the government should honour the promise made on the side of the Vote Leave bus, which said there'd be an extra £350 million a week available for the health service. Labour's Shadow Health Secretary John Ashworth listed what Mr Stevens said would be the consequences of underfunding.
That waiting list will rise from 4 million to 5 million, that cancer care will deteriorate, that the mental health pledges he's committed to won't be met, that the 18-week target will be permanently abandoned. And is it not the case that in the budget next week, if the Chancellor doesn't allocate at least an extra £6 billion a year for the NHS, then he will have failed in his responsibility as Secretary of State?
The Health Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, wasn't having that. He pointed to the five-year forward view Mr Stevens had come up with in 2014, which he said Labour had refused to back.
In the 2015 election, they refused to fund it to the tune of £5.5 billion more that we were prepared to put on this side of the House, his party refused to put in. And what he also said, as he's quoting Simon Stevens, is that when the British economy sneezes, the NHS catches a cold, and it will be far worse than a cold for the NHS if we have Labour's run on the pound.
Last month, Jeremy Hunt said the public sector pay cap of 1% would be lifted for NHS staff in England. Mr Stevens had a view on that too, as John Ashworth explained.
So does he agree with Simon Stevens, who said it would be an own goal not to fully fund the scrapping of that pay cap in the budget next week and expect it to be paid for by productivity gains?
Jeremy Hunt said he'd been very clear.
The government is willing to be flexible in terms of funding additional pay beyond the 1% for nurses, but we do want some important reforms to the contracts that they operate under. And if those negotiations go well, and at the moment we've been having very constructive discussions with the RCN, then I'm hopeful that we can get a deal that everyone will be happy with.
Mr Hunt was pressed on the issue by Labour's Liz McInnes.
What safeguards will the Secretary of State put in place to ensure that NHS trusts do not finance the lifting of the pay cap by making staff cuts, downgrading roles, or reducing terms and conditions under the guise of reforms?
Yeah.
The Health Secretary said the NHS had to make very ambitious cuts as it was.
We have listened carefully to their case that they would not be able to make further efficiency savings to finance an increase in pay beyond the 1%.
Another issue affecting those working in the NHS and their patients are the charges made for parking at hospitals. A Conservative, Robert Halfon, introduced a bill to abolish what he called a stealth tax.
We cannot say in good faith that the NHS is free at the point of access, paid for by general taxation, if people with cars face extortionate and unfair car parking fees.
The bill has received support from all sides of the Commons, but a Conservative MP, James Duddridge, was concerned about the amount of money the NHS would lose if charges were abolished.
That would be a funding gap that would need to be provided. And I think if we have £162 million or £200 million extra, we'd be better spending that on hospital care rather than hospital parking.
Robert Halfon was given leave to introduce his bill, but without government support, it has little chance of becoming law.
Mandy Baker. Now let's return to the debate on the European Union withdrawal bill. MPs spent 4 hours discussing amendments dealing with an exit date and the repeal of the European Communities Act. The second part of the debate focused on any post-Brexit transition period and the role of the European Court of Justice. In her Florence speech, Theresa May proposed what she called an implementation period of around 2 years. The Labour MP Chris Leslie wanted ministers to spell out how any transition would work.
If we don't have that transition, I mean, I've been talking to businesses, I know many honourable members will have been doing the same, they're hearing that really by January, February time, if we haven't got some clarity, they will have no choice but to put in place contingency plans if no deal happens, if we have that fabled cliff edge that takes place at the end of March 2019.
A Conservative former Cabinet Minister, Cheryl Gillan, said the bill contained a mistake.
The bill does not allow anyone who has commenced an action prior to the day of exit the right of a reference to the European Court, which they could have reasonably expected when lodging their claim in the court prior to Brexit.
She proposed another set of amendments so that, as she put it, the rules couldn't be changed halfway through the game. Labour's shadow Brexit minister, Paul Blomfield, also wanted changes and argued that the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice should continue until the end of any transition period. He accused the government of failing to reflect the ambition he said the Prime Minister had shown in her Florence speech 7 weeks ago.
Without acceptance of the continuing role of the Court of Justice during the transition, the idea that the implementation period based on current terms could it happen in the way that the Prime Minister described, is frankly delusional.
He was challenged by a Conservative, Bernard Jenkin, who suggested Labour was putting the cart before the horse.
No transitional implementation period has yet been agreed. It's got to be part of a deal. And it would be a mistake for this House to start putting things into this bill in the expectation of certain things which may or may not happen. And that is why my right honourable friend has announced a separate Act of Parliament to implement any agreement when these sort of things would be dealt with.
The Justice Minister, Dominic Raab, admitted the bill was complex, but said it had the aim of achieving two fundamental objectives.
First, we are delivering on the referendum by taking back control over our laws, a major opportunity, the number one reason people voted to leave the EU in the referendum. And the second thing that this bill does is make sure there is legal certainty, a smooth transition for citizens and businesses, mitigating one of the key risks of Brexit that I think is felt whether you voted leave or remain.
And the debate on the European Union withdrawal bill continues tomorrow. And that's our closing headline from Westminster. MPs have begun their detailed look at the legislation which will take the UK out of the European Union. I'm Sean Curran. The editor was Simon Jones. And that was the Today in Parliament podcast.
There are many more Radio 4 news and current affairs programmes to download for free. Find these on the website at bbc.co.uk/radio4.